Welcome to the Derek Loudermilk Show. This is episode 386 with Sarah Thomas. Sarah Thomas is the founder of the Upper Clarity School of Stone Medicine, and I've been wanting to have her on the show for a long time. You might know that I love crystals. I have my own large healing crystal collection. I've been fascinated with gems and crystals since I was a kid. And Sarah is pretty much the only person that I know of who has taken this ancient Taoist stone medicine tradition and brought it to the West for a modern teaching context. And she also knows a ton about the science behind how crystals and stones work. So we're going to be talking about quantum physics, acupuncture points being scalar energy portals, how monatomic elements are so useful. We're going to talk about how different ways to heal with stones or form relationships with crystals to use them for various things. We're going to be talking about a land and river healing project that I've undertaken, partly with Sarah's guidance. And of course, Sarah's going to mention specific stones that are some of her go-to favorites that you might not have ever heard of or worked with before. So now, here's my interview with Sarah Thomas. Sarah Thomas, welcome to the show.
Hi, Derek. Nice to talk with you. I've been looking forward to it.
Me too. I've been following your work for several years now, and I would characterize you as a stone medicine practitioner, facilitator. I know you're also an acupuncturist. How do you talk about the work you do?
You know, I am an acupuncturist, and I started as an artist, and then I became an acupuncturist. So I'm interested in subtle energy fields and have a lot of experience with the movement of chi and the mystery of, you know, a lot like the invisible worlds. And I did a lot of treatment for a long time in my life. I learned a lot about how people heal. And in that time, I also really dug really deep. I was really lucky to dig really deep into an ancient tradition of stone medicine and crystal healing and apply that. And I think that doing over 10,000 acupuncture and stone and crystal healings with people and continuing to do that makes me a person who, I wouldn't say I have a lot of answers about stone and crystal medicine and how they work, but I have like a great bundle of questions. And I think that's kind of the journey. And I have a lot of experience. So of course I'm still in all of those questions. But yeah, I'm a healer. I'm a ceremonialist. I'm a ritualist. And I love working with the land. At one point, working on the body really just jumped almost like a quantum leap into working with the land. And, you know, if you can apply crystals on the body to move chi, you can apply crystals on the land to move chi. And they, I mean, what came first, the chicken or the egg, you know? So I do both.
What makes crystals and stones special as a healing tool?
Well, I think I want to talk for a second, Derek, about just like the legacy of the Wu to kind of enter that question. In ancient China, there were, you know, schools of people learning Taoist medicine, and ancient China is what I'm really tuned into, and I'm tuned into a few other ancient cultures pretty deeply as well, the Egyptian, the Andean, and some of the North American traditions. But the Taoist one is the one that I'm really centered on. And there were schools going on, there were teachings going on. I think a lot of the time they were man-focused and only men could train in those schools. And women were, they were supposed to get married and have babies. And what happened was women were kind of pushed to the outskirts when it came to like really being able to sink into the knowledge and learn and work with the divine. So they would be on the outskirts, literally. They would move out of towns. They would be far away. Yet they would meditate, you know, every day. There was like this deep going within and connecting from within, because, you know, they couldn't go to the schools. So they had to find that within. And I really resonate with this in my life right now on so many different levels and layers. But these women were called Wu, and they were the people that you would take your children to when they were dying, or go to when you were dying. Or they were people that, it's almost like it was a last resort or something, because they were so shunned. But at the same time, you would go to these places and it was like, wow, miracle healings are happening here, because they were so connected within directly to the divine. And they had really beautiful, interesting practices that were very right-brained, moving around the room in certain ways, you know, touching and connecting things in certain ways. Every single layer of sensory connection was happening. And I think that, you know, now we say the term woo-woo, and it's obviously like a derogatory term most of the time when people say it, because it just means something totally ungrounded, totally silly, just out there and really with like no weight in reality. And that's this oppression. I mean, that's a form of oppression, honestly, on the legacy of the woo and all of our connection to the divine within, whether you're a woman or a man or whatever, something in between. That connection to the divine within is oppressed. It's still oppressed the way that it was then, the way that these ancient women healers would have to hide or run for their lives, even in some cases, or work on the outskirts of town by themselves. To this day, it's like we get called woo-woo, or people make fun of crystals. And I mean, they say it all the time on podcasts and everything. That's so silly. Go get your crystal. And I just really sense that oppression as kind of like, I want us to tune into that as an oppression on all of us and our ability to just go within and know and have answers from within, and the magic that we all are, the magic that we create, the magic that we can create on our own. And stone medicine, to get to your question, stone medicine is connected to that realm, because it is the deep, intuitive, subtle forces that come off of stones. And in the subtle, there's a lot of information. And in the subtle, we can kind of make our way into other dimensions. We can walk through that wall and enter another dimension. And the Chinese character for Wu is a picture of a person actually walking through a wall and entering another dimension. So that, in essence, is what these Wu were doing. They could walk through a wall and enter the dimension of the foxes, or enter the dimension of the ants, or enter the dimension of the star people, or enter the dimension of you know, the Wu in the other town. So they're able to walk through and experience other dimensions. And that's the Wu. And that's what stones really offer us, is the ability to go into those subtle fields and experience multiple dimensions. And I still feel like there's this like oppressive force over that piece of empowerment, and that's something that we get to kind of usher in freedom from that oppression in this like new age of crystal consciousness.
Wow. That's a much deeper answer than I was expecting. And it adds some importance, some weight to this conversation or to the work that you're doing. You know, I think a lot of people, and myself included, like I had rock collections as a kid and I was fascinated by them, just, you know, looking at their beauty. That's where I go when I go to a natural history museum. I go to the gem exhibit first, just because I want to stare at the gems. And there's something about these that draw so many people, men and women, you know, rock collectors all over. And I think on some level, we know there's something there for us beyond just a beautiful object. But that, you know, until recently, I myself wouldn't have looked any deeper or tried to tune into any subtle information fields. So it feels like a big blue ocean of opportunity here for us.
Yeah. And I think the state of consciousness that most of humanity is in a place where they really just are very bound into the 3D world, you know, the world of the senses. And it's a very, it's a rare thing, honestly, to have the level of consciousness rise up or the heart open enough to start to experience other worlds. We have to sit down. We have to go within. We have to slow down. And it's just not the direction that the world moves. But when we do, and you know this, like in our moments of ceremony, in our moments of ritual, I know that people are doing this, just even if they light a candle in the morning and sit for 5 minutes or sit in the evening for 5 minutes, these worlds are opening up faster and more than they ever have before. And people are getting in touch with these worlds faster and more. So I think our level of consciousness as humans is rising. But the reason that we haven't been able to like really tap into stones is because we haven't been able to experience these multiple dimensions, because it requires a little raise in consciousness, which I think we're experiencing now.
And still stones, as we perceive them, are, you know, these physical objects. Is there anything to their physicality that is either the cause or the effect or the signature of why they can do what they do?
Yeah, I think people overlook the importance of physicality and the material aspect of the stones. And in fact, that kind of defines why I say stone medicine rather than crystal healing. Saying stone medicine is like saying herbal medicine. It means that you're actually looking at all the constituents in the stone, and you're looking at the material makeup, just like you would look at herbs and say, okay, this herb has this in it, has this in it, so it's going to go to my kidney, or it's going to go to my bladder, it's going to go to my heart. Do the same exact thing with stones. And there's different classifications. So you can look at the crystal structure of a stone, which is very material, absolutely fascinating that the earth created these seven crystal systems, and they affect the energy field subtly in different ways. You can look at the chemical composition of a stone, which is another huge hotbed of where we get data and information about stones. Function follows form. So there's a reason why everything forms the way that it does. You can look at color, which is obviously going to have an effect on all of the fields of the body, physical, mental, emotional, spiritual, the outer energy fields. And there are about 16 total classifications that I have kind of identified, including taste, temperature. Not that I identified all these, but I kind of put them into the number 16 so I could keep looking at how does the way the stone interact with light affect us, like rate of dispersion. How does the density of the stone affect us, like specific gravity? And the earth created all these things in such specific ways because they affect, not just affect, but they bring in subtle frequency based on that form.
And so, you know, I know, you know, like with the different types of crystals, they grow in different patterns. The molecular makeup leads them to, you know, be hexagonal, or, you know, the different, so that's with crystals anyway. So why is that? How is that sort of crystalline structure? Why is that useful or important?
Because shape is very important in how subtle energy moves from the oneness through all dimensions into this material plane. Shape is something that subtle energy frequencies look at and say, oh, okay, I see that shape. I know that that means that I can, almost like a light ray. You can think of a light ray bending so that it becomes one of the colors of the rainbow. So I know that I can kind of enter that shape and refract in a certain way or refine myself in a certain way. And these are like qualitative, multidimensional energies. So one example is the diamond shape tends to purify. It tends to clear things out. In the center of any shape, there is a kind of a portal to the singularity in the center of a shape. And that diamond shape works that energy into the center of that portal to transmute energy. So if you look around at different traditions, and this would be the rhombus or the rhombic crystal system or shape in crystals. But if you look at different cultures, you'll see that they use the diamond a lot when they're trying to clear a space. Like the Mexican Eye of God is always shaped in a diamond. So they all have these different ways that they work with energy.
And then when you work with healing, are you placing stones physically on people's bodies? And then there's an effect of the stone on the person's physical nature? Like how does the healing process work?
Well, we can, as an acupuncturist, I work a lot with placing the stones on acupuncture points, because those are all little scalar energy pools as well, superconductive little spots. And I also move into a little bit more right-brained, holistic way of looking things, where I'll stand back and say, okay, what is the grid that needs to be placed on the body? Instead of finding the point on the meridian, standing back and with right brain saying, like, what is the shape that I need to create on the body to achieve a desired effect? So things can be placed in grids on the body in certain shapes, or they can be placed directly on acupuncture points. And that's how I work. Both of those ways are the main ways that I work.
And does it matter how big a stone is?
It depends on what application we're talking about. So if you make an elixir, the crystal can be very, very small, and it will put its essence into a whole gallon of water or more. It can be a tiny crystal, and it will fill that whole gallon of water with its essence and make that water an elixir. So size doesn't matter in elixirs or in placing crystals on the body. Size starts to matter more if you're moving into feng shui applications or putting crystals on the land, because in one way, the bigger the crystal is, the more it's going to affect the electromagnetic field and kind of be able to cohere certain waves around it or connect to each other. If you have two crystals really far apart on a land and they're quite large, they have a little bit of an easier time kind of finding each other, especially if they're really far away. So that's where size comes in, I think. Size matters more in these vibrational applications where the stones are feng shui, they're in your home, they're placed around you, and it matters less in on the body and elixirs.
What are some sort of surprising ways to use stones and crystals that people might not have thought of before?
Well, Derek, I always think that, you know, I just think people don't make elixirs enough because, you know, we get these stones that we love or someone will give us a stone. I hear this from people all the time, people who are not even in the healing world or anything. Someone just emailed me on my business team, who's just a business person. And they said, so funny. My mom gave me this opal. I feel it's really significant. So what do I do? Like, what do I do with this opal? How do I learn about it? So everybody, I feel like, has a moment where they get in touch with a stone and they're like, this is special. And to really learn that stone, it's really important to consider opening that stone up inside of you, you know, opening it up inside of you. So you take it in and you can actually have tantra, have union with the stone. You can take it in through an elixir. And when you make a crystal elixir and then you drink that elixir, the essence of the stone actually does a cellular activation and at the DNA level, because these are stones, they work at a really deep level. So we can have the special stone. And I would say to this person in my business, I would say, so why don't you make an elixir of this opal and start drinking it every day and see what happens? Because when you open it up inside of you, the stone has an opportunity to speak to you in its language. And its language is definitely not the mind and the way that we think, and our constant kind of radio channels of the mind and binary yes, no, good, bad thinking. The stone definitely speaks through dreams, subtle energies, knowings, mystical experiences that we have. So they have this whole way they communicate. And once you get it inside your body like that, that can kind of like proliferate and bloom inside of you.
That reminds me of something that I heard you say in the course that I took from you. Is like, you can't use left brain thinking to solve a problem. How did you characterize it? Solve like a solve a problem in infinity or solve a problem in now I'm putting it, but it's like you're trying to use your thinking mind to solve problems that aren't in the thinking realm.
Yeah. Do you mind if I give you a great example of that?
Sure.
It's that we have this whole question now around ethics and sustainability in mining and getting crystals. And it's kind of become the buzzword. So a crystal shop will say, we are ethical and sustainable. And that will kind of like put them to the top. And so people are looking for that. But what does all of that really mean? I mean, what is a sustainable stone? If a stone takes thousands or millions, I mean, the garnet here in the mountains take 450 million years to form. I mean, we often think of sustainability as like you plant this corn and then you can plant it again, you can plant it again, you can plant it again. I mean, you can't make a 450 million year garnet again and again and again. So sustainability is like, we have to think about that in a different way in the crystal world. And ethics, we have to think about that too, because, you know, obviously mining is happening all over the world. We're mining, I mean, horrible things are happening with mining. Horrible things are happening mining with, sadly, around the electric car industry, around cobalt. Changes are happening around lithium. But, you know, we're mining the earth for all of these things that we use, like zinc and all of these things that we use in our computers and everything. It's just a big ethical question. And a lot of the crystals that we work with, we look at ethics and sustainability. Where did this come from? Did a person get this, like, for instance, the crystals that we get from Africa, we've worked with this family for a long time where the brother is the rock hunter. He has a small plot of land that he's rock hunted for many, many years. And then the other brother helps send the crystals out into the world and they feed their family and they help feed their community. And we look for things like that. Now, but the whole questions of ethics and sustainability in the stone and crystal world and mining is like, we are not going to find an answer to that in the state of consciousness that we're in, because in the state of consciousness that we're in, everything is good or bad or right or wrong. That's polarity. And polarity is always going to be like that. It's good or bad or right or wrong. But I know that there is an actual unified field where good and bad and right and wrong don't exist anymore. And if there's ever one answer to this question about ethics and sustainability in mining, the answer, you know, or the next evolution of it is going to be attained in the unified field. Because as long as we're here in this polarity, this good, bad, right, wrong, we're going to say it's good or we're going to say it's bad. Someone's going to say it's right. Someone's going to say it's wrong. And there's always just going to be a division of what's true. But the real answer to what's going on with sustainability and ethics is in the unified field, and it's beyond right and wrong. And that's where the earth itself actually operates. The earth itself is that higher dimensional being that is in that realm. And I want to say something radical, Derek. I just want to say that we, in the state of consciousness we're into, people often call this reptilian, but we see everything as, what sums it up perfectly is like, if there's one piece of food, but there's three people that need to eat or they die, right? That's how we are. We are like, oh my gosh, scarcity. Oh my gosh, I have to fight for this piece of food. That's how the mind is. I should say that's how the self is. Mm-hmm. It's not who we really are, but that's kind of the program of the self. I have to fight for this. There's scarcity. I mean, how terrified would you be if you had to have this piece of food and there were two other people there and you had to fight for it or you would die? That's the root of the program of the self. And it's so wrapped up in scarcity and it's so wrapped up in fear. And we take that scarcity program and we project it onto the earth and we say, earth is scarce. We don't have enough. There's not enough. Like, everybody has to fight for this. Mining is bad. Taking crystals out of the earth is bad. We should fight for this. We should be in arguments about this. We should have fear about this. But the earth itself is always talking to me about abundance. She is not in that scarcity place. She's in this place of, there is eternal energy. There is infinite energy. There's no end. I mean, if you pull up one piece of tourmaline, there's 5 million pieces of tourmaline behind it. That's what she's been trying to share with me over all these years of like, just to see that program of scarcity and inviting me to see her that she's not in that program.
Wow. Already I'm patting myself on the back for having you on my show, because this is great stuff.
Good.
And it's reminding me of, I read Braiding Sweetgrass last year. It made a huge impact on me. And Robin Wall Kimmerer talks about the noble harvest when she's talking about going and collecting herbs or food out in nature. You always sort of greet and bypass the first plant that you're going to harvest, because that might also be the last one you encounter. And you also ask permission to harvest and then make some type of offering in reciprocity for the gift of the food or the medicine that you're receiving. And I know you often, you say like, ask if you're going to go out rock hounding or if you're going to collect a stone, ask if it wants to go with you. Could you talk a little bit about just that practice?
Yeah, there are mines here. And I used to take people rock hounding. I used to take groups rock hounding, and it was so fun. And we'd go discover these places and rock hounds. And I stopped being able to do that because if I would take 12 people or 20 people, they would tell another 50 people, and then they would tell another 50 people, and all these cool secret locations where the minerals were in these mountains were, you know, it's too much people going up there that don't have these practices in place or wouldn't think like that. But we would go up to these places, and it's so funny. People have these different reactions. Like, I know my partner, for instance, when we go out crystal hunting, she's just like, I don't want to take any of the crystals. Like, they look awesome here. I mean, they're just beautiful. Like, I don't want to take them from where they are, you know, and her best friend is like that too. And then I have other people that are like, for me, for instance, I'm like, if I feel resonant that this crystal wants to come do healing work with me, it's like, it's giving it a job. It's giving it a purpose. And my teacher always says that all stones have a soul and all souls have a destiny. So it's like almost allowing the stone to have a destiny. And working with my stones over all this time, they have we have a relationship. They feel very, very happy. They feel very bonded to each other. I know I sound kind of funny saying how my stones feel, but I mean, that's my inner experience. We have a lot of great rapport. They love working with people. So I feel like it's okay to take a stone out of nature and work with it a little bit. I've put stones back in nature before. And yes, it's, you know, the language is reciprocity, of course, you know, give back if you're going to take something. And I love what you said about braiding sweetgrass, but I think the ultimate answer is like to let yourself feel how you feel about it. Like my partner can let herself feel that way, and her friend can let herself feel that way. And people that come out and feel like, this stone really called to me, like I want to bring it home and relate with it and activate it and make medicine with it, to let themselves feel that way. And yeah, it's always great to bring offerings everywhere that you go and tune in for a little bit, because I really trust that people know that if you get a no, it's a no. And if you don't get a clear yes, it's a no. If you don't get a clear yes, it's a no. So just going out and tuning into that clear yes, it's okay. And you can leave things and you can let yourself feel how you feel about it, you know?
Do you have certain stones that are your go-to, that you find yourself working with the most?
I was just saying this week that it's interesting. I think sphalerite is a stone that I've just been working with so much, especially in the past couple of years. Sphalerite is, it is a mix of iron and sulfur, which would be pyrite, right? If it was by itself, iron and sulfur, two powerhouses. And when iron and sulfur come together, it's like a union of opposites. So it's this really transformational stone. But when you add zinc to that, you have zinc, iron, and sulfur, and that is sphalerite. And sphal rate is incredible. I hope that people listening can maybe get a piece of sphal rate, even if you get a small piece. I think it is definitely one of the most underutilized, underappreciated stones in the entire crystal world, because it is a master. I mean, it's the GOAT. It's the greatest of all time at entity clearing. I think it's the GOAT at entity clearing. It just takes energy out. It's like a vacuum. So I put it in people's hands all the time when I'm doing any kind of clearing work. And it strongly transmutes energy. And it has that sulfur in it. It has that sulfur pyrite transformational quality plus zinc. And it strongly transmutes energy very deep in the body. Like imagine a vortex going all the way down into the DNA, where you start to touch the programming, the conditioning, the karmic imprints, the genetic imprints, any kind of subtle energies like, you know, spells that have been cast. And there's so many different energies out there that are attached to us that aren't us. Think of that vortex going all the way down to the level of DNA, like a spell that got cast on your ancestor and it's still living inside your DNA. That stone goes so deep and unwinds things in such a masterful way that you almost don't even need to know what you're doing. You can just let that stone kind of guide the work. Oh, and then it's also extremely tonifying. What's crazy about it is it's as generative and tonifying as it is releasing. And that's, you usually aren't the GOAT at two things. I mean, Tom Brady can't be the GOAT at football and at his marriage. That's what someone just said recently. You can only be the GOAT at one thing, but this stone is kind of the greatest of all time at releasing and transmuting energy and tonifying energy, like the will to live. I mean, if somebody's like fighting for their lives, the zinc and sphalerate go so deep to bring back that I am, I will live, I will make it through this. It's a deep tonification as well.
Wow. Yeah, I don't know much about anything. I know you've been talking in the last few days. I said much about anything. I don't know, as you know, I've never heard of using the stone really before. I haven't looked it up, but I know you've been talking about getting some of this sphalerite from a particular mine, the Elmwood mine. Can you talk about the significance of where certain stones come from? Because I know there's like Brandberg amethyst from this one place in Africa are supposed to be super powerful, or, you know, certain, you may have the same stone, but from different locations, it has a whole different feel to it. What's the, like where it comes from? What's the importance of that?
I think about how ancient people who were at a different level of consciousness than us, true ancient people were at a very high level of consciousness. And when they got information from ancient teachings that are so, so old that you wouldn't even call these beings the human species. They have these ancient teachings, and these come out through the Sanskrit language. They come out through some modes of Hinduism, some modes of mantra. They're still alive today. And through the ancient Egyptian culture as well, they still come through. But what they did was they would just read the energy of the earth. They were very in tune with finding the power spots in the earth. And then when they would build a temple, they would tune into what is a specific energy coming out of this power spot in the earth. And they would match that energy with how they would build the temple. And they would also, whatever deity they placed inside, say it was Lord Ganesha, they would match that energy of that deity with the energy coming out of the earth. So the power spot defines the certain ritual that's going to happen there for people. And then they build a temple in a certain way that layers on top of that. And then they put the deity in there in a certain way that layers on top of that. And so an example would be, wow, there's an energy coming out of the earth here of abundance, of wealth, of, you know, just having enough and energy just pouring out with abundance. If they could feel that energy, they would then build the temple in a way that would increase that. They would put a goddess in there like Lakshmi, right? That also does that. And then everybody that goes to that temple, what would happen to them is they would get programming and conditioning that blocks that abundance. You know, all the programming and conditioning that we have removed, they would get that cleared. So it's like this becoming transparent process of getting all of the programming conditioning out of us. And so you'd go to that temple, you'd have this experience, and it's sometimes a hard experience because it's like mining the shadow. You're getting the programming and the conditioning out of you, but it's all geared towards a higher experience of abundance. And so the first part in that was being able to define the certain quality of energy coming from that power. So there's so much we don't know about this. There is a mine that I've been talking about in Tennessee that has really, really special crystals coming out of it. And the crystals are getting all blown up in the mining process that they're doing. They're mining for something else, and the crystals just happen to be there. So the crystals are getting blown up. These incredible crystals are getting blown up. And sometimes they're getting kind of like saved and taken out. The energy coming out of that power spot is something we're still, I mean, for years, I've been kind of dancing around it, like figuring out what is the medicine coming out of this power spot, but it's going to be included in all of those crystals. And one of the big energies coming out of the power spot that I'm talking about right now is the energy of releasing really old, deep karmic pains, really old, deep karmic patterns, transmuting things so down deep to the root that they're, remember I was talking about the reptilian energy of scarcity and how the self kind of functions like that's just a program. But to be able to go that deep into programming and release that stuff and transmute that stuff, that's very, very powerful for human awakening. I mean, that's our process right now, is this purification. So all of these different power spots have these different energies, and us tuning into what they are is, I think, a really cool thing for us to think about.
Yeah, and I can hear in my head the voice saying it's beyond the 3D, but I'm wondering, is there a measurable component, like a 3D measurable thing we can like measure the field of the power spot or like sense it with an instrument, or is it really only a matter of tuning in and you just have to know it without measuring it? Is there? Yeah, can you talk about that?
There's all of it. I've worked with dowsers who just have this one little clear pendulum, and they're phenomenal. And they have been doing it their whole lives, and their grandfather did it, and their grandmother did it, and they can tune in and discern every little question about what's going on. And then I think it's a good an example of Egyptian biogeometry. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that, but it's just an ancient practice out of Egypt where they are able to identify these subtle qualitative factors that, and they're very attuned to power spots. So it's connected to French radiesthesia, which is working with pendulums, but not through the subconscious, not through saying like yes or no questions. It's not like that. It's like the pendulum's actually created in such a way, it's weighted in such a way, the length of the string is a certain way, the shape of the pendulum in a certain way, that all you have to do is hold it over an area and the pendulum will pick up the subtle energy vibrations, and you're not asking yes or no questions. And it can show you a whole scale of qualitative energies coming out of that place. So the answer to your question, I think, is like all of it. People can do that. I met a man in Iona. I was on the island of Iona in Scotland, and I was finding a power spot there that was secret. They don't have any signs for it. I mean, it's totally secret. It's the most amazing thing. It's this rock that is in the shape of like the Venus of Willendorf, like a very fertile goddess. And it's this old weathered rock. It's about, you know, this big maybe. And it's embedded in the side of this, what is now a church or an abbey. And that is the original rock the Druids placed there when they were training long, long, long time ago to get in touch with the earth and hear her and feel her essence. That's where they used to go to train on that island, an incredible magical island. And this rock is like, that was their touch. That was their foundational spiritual stone, the fertility goddess. You know, they were, you know, connected to the mother. And then the Catholics or Christians came in and brought the patriarchy. But before that, they were connected to the mother and the earth mother. And this thing is covered over with construction. And like, there's like, I mean, it's just hidden. Like no tourist would ever see that. Mm-hmm. And there's touristy things like, look at this and look at that. It's just hidden there. And I was climbed through the construction stuff. And I wasn't supposed to be doing that. Like climbed through the bars and went up and like touched this stone. And it was awesome. And I turned around and this guy that looked kind of like you, Derek, he had a big beard and he had just like these really sweet eyes, and he was a local, and he said, "Looks like you found the spot." And I said, "Yeah." He's like, "How do you find the spots here? Like, I want to find the rest of the spots." And he started talking about his process, and he said, "You know, I have found the spots like over my life, and I'll just get drawn there." And he told me the story of finding this stone out in the middle of nowhere on this island, that when he finally made it, it was kind of like a years long process of listening to his intuition. When he finally made it, he touched that stone and just wept and wept and wept. And he knew that it was like why he came to this earth, you know, like a big part of his destiny was just to get that transmission. And so he was really cool. And I said, "Well, how do you find the spots?" And he said, "I just follow my beard." And I was like, "Beard?" And he's like, "Yeah, my beard is, it's his dowsing rod." You know, it's like he had it in his body. He didn't need a pendulum. Yeah, he meant that too. Like he had that energy attunement after all that time to just follow his beard.
Yeah, it's making me think of this. You might know a little bit about this project that I've sort of undertaken, which I really don't know what it is, but I keep getting these little nudges and guidance of. So I live in St. Louis. It's known as a violent, segregated place right now. You know, there's a lot of murders here and whatnot. And but I see it also as a place that's ripe for a renaissance. You know, because there's it's like one of these hidden gems. You know, nobody would know about St. Louis, and then people come here and they're like, "Oh my gosh, this is amazing! Like all the museums and gardens and parks are all free, and everyone you know enjoys them." So I took your land healing earth grid course because it sort of aligns with this project, which is like a large crystal grid, but also healing the rivers, because the rivers here are all connected to, you know, this is like the most, the Mississippi, the Missouri, the Illinois, the Ohio, the Merrimack, all these river systems sort of come through this one node, and it's like the most watery place on the whole planet pretty much. And so there's feels this significance to St. Louis, and we have the Cahokia civilization that was here, which is the largest earthen pyramids in North America. And there's just a lot of significance. But so I've got all this like information, and I'm like, okay, I'm supposed to do something. I'm supposed to do like a citywide collective prayer, consciousness, land, water healing thing, but I don't really know what it is. And so it's been slow to get going because I didn't really know where to start. And we finally did the first part of it, which is at the confluence of the Mississippi and Missouri rivers, the two biggest river systems. We just did the ceremony on the solstice, and it, you know, I was like, okay, this is a magical spot, this confluence spot, because there's just a lot passing through here. But I feel like I'm still just sort of waiting for the guidance to come about what it is I'm supposed to do and how to mobilize people to do it. But it seems, you know, it's taken on a life of its own in a way, and people want to participate. And so I feel like I'm part of my responsibility is just to keep facilitating the chance for people to put their healing into this type of thing. I don't know, any thoughts about that?
You know, you sound like first chair in the ceremony. When we say first chair, it's like that's the person in the ceremonial circle who is responsible for channeling in the divine, you know, channeling in the voice of the mother and just being a clear channel for the mother. So that you get direction from her on what happens. So it sounds like you are, you know, kind of like the networker, the one who's going to bring people together and kind of like do that practical part of the journey. But you feel like also the one who has to bring this information in and be a clear channel. Have you picked anything up yet about, I'm sure you have, but I mean, you've got the clear hit that we have to do something.
Yeah. You know, I'm trying not to think my way through it so much since I do have such a tendency to do that. And so it was a really great practice for me to do this first one, just to go out there and just kind of fumble my way through the first ceremony. And, I was really pleased to see like what gifts people brought their personal skills, and you know, whether it was like this Hawaiian woman came and she had brought waters from all over the world. Like people just give her water from, you know, the Dead Sea or Lourdes in France or the Amazon or, you know, wherever they are, they just bring her water. And so we had water from the whole planet that we sort of re-added back into the Mississippi and Missouri rivers. And, you know, when we did that, she was singing this prayer and she poured the water in, and all of a sudden the sun like pierced through the clouds and shone like right down on her. And this like huge, you know, 10,000 strong flock of birds like made this big bird tornado. And I was like, whoa, this is amazing. And we all knew that it was cool and special and amazing. And I still felt like, I don't, you know, I know this is good. It feels good, but I still don't know like what it is that we're doing.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, my thought in response to this, like, is I think of the Peruvian Caro people who, when they want to open the door to a space and gain a relationship with it, they just keep going back. And they'll sit at, when they find little places that are like, this feels like the door to the place, the first door. And then this feels kind of like the second door to the place. We'll do a ceremony at the first door, a lot of prayers at the first door, just, you know, putting down beautiful flowers and a lot of offerings at the first door. And then they wait until they get like invited to the second door and get a little bit closer to it. And then they'll do a lot of processes and ceremonies there. And they just kind of like let that space draw them in. But I feel like I've been there at those ceremonies, and it's nothing about being perfect. It's just about going and spending time at that door and just going back. I feel like, Derek, if you just like are like, you know what, every new moon, we're just going to go there. Like, that might be all you have to know.
Yeah, it's a kind of a hard to get to place. It's like, because it's a, you know, when two rivers come together, it's a very fine point. And so you have to go like way up and around and come down to hit that point. And I was looking, all these confluences are kind of hard to get to, just because of the way that the land is structured. So I have the Taoist magic circle set up in my yard, like you know, 36 stones in a circle. And I was like, maybe I'll just connect. So I put a placeholder at the confluence, like I buried some stones connected to that portal, so that I could just like, instead of driving up there, I could just like sit down in my yard and go there.
How? That's so smart.
To save time. Yeah.
That's it. Also, you can, you know, as you know, you can print out an image of that spot.
And yeah, one thing that was really cool was someone, maybe one of your other students, printed out. Actually, she made a watercolor of the region. So she like watercolored in the rivers, and then she channeled symbols to overlay on top of the painting she had done. And what was really interesting was these, she was like, okay, I need to put some paisley in there. And the paisley ended up sort of making this heart shape over top of the region, which is really fascinating, because people have called St. Louis the sort of the heart center of the country. It's in a lot of ways, it sort of represents the whole country, because we have the sort of exact mix of diversity that the whole country has. We have like ethnically, you know, the average of the whole country. We have the, you know, the land. It's like the mix of the whole country, all these things. So it was just really cool to see like what's possible to overlay on top of a map or an image of a place.
Yeah. It's like, we can print out images on our computer and have fun with that and do that. And I've been reading lately about, you know, with ancient cave paintings, they weren't actually doing art. What they were doing is they would draw the picture of the animal. And they knew that when they drew that image, that the subtle energy of the animal through resonance would actually come into the image. And that means that they're now kind of like interacting with that prey animal through subtle energy fields, because they drew the image. And when they knew that, and when they would draw spears pointing at it and everything, that was actually the beginning of the hunt. That was when they started to work on the animal, because that would weaken the animal just by drawing spears at it, and like drawing it going down and drawing it getting chased, and all those spears would actually weaken the animal through resonance. And those resonant harmonics, it's like, I feel like they're definitely important, but something happens when we draw the image instead of take a picture of it. There's just something different in that energy of drawing it. Hmm. Where we bring in the qualitative multidimensional aspects of the actual animal come into the cave.
I feel like that might tip the animal off though a little bit too. Like, yeah. Oh, someone's drawing me on a wall. Like, maybe yeah, I should be scarce for a little while.
Yeah. Maybe it's like, I'm starting to feel sick. I should go somewhere else.
Earliest known voodoo doll.
Yeah. Earliest known radionics machine.
What is radionics? I'm not sure I know that term.
It is the... It comes from Albert Abrams working, basically just working at a distance, and how he created these frequency machines to work at a distance. And we now kind of use that word in a lot of different ways. If we're going to say, I drew a picture of a person and put the crystals on the picture, you could kind of almost call that a radionics machine. You're working at a distance.
I kind of want to jump around a little bit. Dragons have been coming up a lot for me recently. People on social media have been talking about them. You know, just a lot of synchronicities around dragons. And I seem to remember you had some sort of teaching around dragons. What can you say about dragons?
You know, my own mentors, guides, ceremonialists, seers that have worked with me for a long time, they always say they see dragons around me. So there's a connection with me and dragons, maybe you too, Derek. Always feeling like a connection for me to the earth grid, the ley lines, like, you know, the dragon lines. And the teaching that I share about dragons is actually an ancient protocol from ancient China around transmuting entities. And you can actually touch these seven points on the body, and these seven points will summon what we call the internal dragons, or they'll summon what we call the external dragons. But these dragons come up and they're actually friendly and they're good and they're your allies, but they're so powerful and so transmutational that they blow away the entity. They transmute the entities in your body. They clear you. And the treatment goes back a long, long way. I've done a lot of study on like who actually wrote this treatment, and it's kind of clouded, but I think of all the treatments that I've ever done, I've probably done this one the most, because when people come to me, the first thing that I want to do is weed the garden. No, I don't want to start planting flowers if there's a bunch of weeds. And people are like gardens. They get a lot of weeds built up in them on every level. So one of the first things that I do with people is do that dragon's treatment and just touch those seven points and get this major transmutation happening, not just in the spirit level or the primary level of our everyday life, but on the soul level. I just did this recently and just had an incredible experience that I felt this woman's heart pulse. And I just felt, as soon as I felt the heart, I felt like, so pulse is one of the way I diagnose, but you don't have to be able to do this to do these treatments. I felt something just totally trapped, like going like this, like it was just trapped. And I said, oh my God, this is so much anxiety. Like, you have had anxiety since you were a child. And she looked at me and was like, yes, I have so much anxiety. She's like, I hide it so well. Cause she on the outside, she's just like this cool chill stoner that like wants to go on a hike, but she's like, no, I have so much anxiety. And, you know, I was like, this is past life. I mean, this is really deep. It's beyond childhood. This goes back into past lives. I'm like, where are you trapped? I was like, I feel like you're trapped in a car. Like your car went over a bridge and you're like submersed in water and you're like trying to get out the windows to get out of the car. And she is like, opened her eyes. So I was like, oh my God, I am so scared of bridges. I feel like I died going off a bridge. I can't even go over bridges. I avoid them. She's like, I've always known that I have a past life blockage that has created all of the anxiety in my life. And you just like nailed it. And we did the internal dragons treatment and we're able to clear such a deep level of energy and transmute, you know, this anxiety that's followed her whole life by bringing those dragons out and bringing presence to it. Honestly, it's the presence that heals. If anything heals, it's presence. So it's us becoming conscious of it and being present with it that creates the space for it to shift. And then the dragons, they're actually from the oneness. They're from a very, very high dimension. They're from the oneness. And they have the ability to like walk things back to the oneness, you know, to release things back into pure light. She's doing better.
Wow. And is there a particular stone that you use to sort of call in the dragons?
Yeah. If anybody's interested to learn that technique, we have a class on it. And in the class, I share about seven different minerals that work really well. And the sphalerite would be one of them because we just talked about it being so good at entity clearing. Fluorite is another one because fluorite is just kind of a master of dematerialization. It's very good at clearing energy as well. Sulfur is incredible. You know, sulfur is like the brimstone. It's like the breath of the dragon. It's so transmutational. So those are three examples.
Cool. Yeah, I'm glad I asked you about that.
Yeah.
Interesting dragons. I want to ask you also about record keepers. There's stones that have like etching in them or stones that are like Lemurian crystals with lines on them. And I know that quartz in particular is really good at storing information, but you know, when we talk about record keepers, it could be sapphire or ruby or any number of other stones. What is that? Is there actually information like programmed in there by ancient people so that we could get it now? Or what's going on with these record keeper stones?
In the past, people that really studied stones and minerals and were kind of masters at understanding form and function. And like I said, ancient, like real ancient mammals, like at a higher level of consciousness, there's a moment that they were at a higher level and they could just see these things. And when they would see little triangles on a crystal, like those little triangles that you see that we call record keepers, like the little triangle imprints or the lines on the crystal, sometimes there's just like etching marks that look like, you know, a form of Sanskrit or a form of like Japanese writing or something. When they would see that, they would say something was writing into the stone because I see the writing on the outside and what is without is within, just by hermetic principles. So they would say something was writing on this and something imprinted frequency into this, something coded this. And then the process starts of, so what is the encodement? And this is an exploration for all of us. If we have a stone with lines etched on it, no matter if it's quartz or something else, or we have those little imprints, one of my favorite things to do is make an elixir of that stone and invite that encodement into your body and then let that encodement proliferate from within and see what dreams you get. I have had such incredible experiences with elixirs, things that I could never, ever expect or anticipate. It's really like talking directly with the field. And then you start to get this imprint. And some people don't feel the imprint for a year. It's like it'll get in their body and do. And then it comes out at one point, almost like a time capsule. So yes, some of these stones have incredible. Do you want to hear a really quick story? One of the first times I ever made a crystal elixir, I was traveling out west and I was driving all the way out west. I was like 21 years old or something, 22 years old. And I landed at this like dusty old crystal shop outside of Santa Fe. And I like pulled my car over in the dust really fast and all the dust flew up because I see like crystal shop, you know how that goes. And I want to go to the rock shop and it's this dusty, dirty old, like just everything was, I keep saying dusty because everything was dusty in there. It was poorly lit. It was just someone sitting behind the counter and the stones were in these like drawers and chests and it was awesome. I wish I could go back to that crystal shop. And in one drawer, I pulled out in this bottom drawer, and there's this incredible quartz crystal. And I just felt immediately connected to it. Like, that's my crystal. That's why I'm here. That's why I'm all the way out here. I mean, this is what's been calling me. And I take it up to the person and I'm like, what is this crystal? Like, do you know anything about this? And it was a quartz crystal. It had a couple little kind of like babies with it, and it had smoky energy at its base, but it was clear at the top. And it had all these record keeper lines on it, beautiful record keeper lines. And they said, I don't know, but I just know that's from Tibet. That's all I know about that crystal. It's a quartz from Tibet. Once I got done with my cross country, I came home and I made an elixir of that crystal because I wanted to know what it was. So I wanted to take it in inside of me. And I drank it one night, the elixir. By the way, if you're going to make crystal elixirs, please take my course or someone else's on how to make crystal elixir safely. You can't just put any stone in water. Mm-mm. You can get heavy metal poisonings. So you really have to educate yourself before you do that. You do not want a heavy metal poison yourself or others. Nonetheless, I make the crystal elixir. Nothing really happens. I go to bed. I wake up the next morning, and before I even open my eyes, I felt the most elevated, exquisite feeling in my body that I have ever felt before. I felt like I was bodiless. I was weightless. I felt like I was pure sex. And it was like how you might feel when you die. I would imagine that you're free of the body. And I just lay there and I was like hearing this beautiful tone, and my body was sound and I was weightless. And I'm like, don't go away. And, you know, I started coming like, don't go away. Don't go away. How do I get this to not go away? And for about a minute and a half, it lasted. And I kind of like came back into density. And that was the best feeling in my body I have ever had. And what I want to make a story that happened, I mean, it went away, but I think in that moment, I was encoded with something that lasts today, that still comes out of me today. And I have this story that perhaps I even planted that crystal in ancient Tibet, or someone who loves me, or a mentor, a teacher, or somebody put that encodement in there like a time capsule, knew that I would find it in this lifetime and could give me the energy of like, remember what it is to be pure sound, you know, remember the origin of life. And these are the kind of like cool journeys we get to go on when we talk about record keepers and elixirs. It's how do you say it in any way that anybody could track it or write that down or research it? Or it's the unnameable, it's the unknowable, it's the mystery.
I do love that idea of like previous lives leaving time capsules for our current selves. And something that I dreamed recently. I'm working on creating a new program, a transformational program. I realized that there's one of the workshops in the program is actually us going back in time to start the program. So it's like each person that's there participating, we're like calling ourselves in by kicking off the sequence of events in our past that all lead us to that moment. And I dreamt of that moment and I was like, oh, that's what it'll be like when I'm in the future, like telling my past self, I'm going to send it to my dream time. So I'll know to orchestrate this thing that's happening. And I was like, whoa, I never really thought of, you know, because we think of linear time, like I'm going to leave a thing for my future self. But this is the first time I thought like, I'm going to do a thing to help my past self on a process.
That's beautiful. Like your current self in the dream, like planted something for your past self.
No, my future self sent back something for me now in the present.
Oh, I love that. Your future self sends something back for you in the present. The whole, like, I think exploring time and crystals' relationship to time is another deep thing that we could talk about.
I wanted to ask you about time crystals, actually.
Oh, yeah.
Have you heard of time crystals?
I have heard of time crystals. I want to do a little, I'm bringing my podcast back, but I want to do a little episode on, you know, the secret life of crystals and emergent technology, because crystals are doing so many wild things right now. And they're always right at the edge of, they're always right at the edge of our interface with extra dimensional worlds. It's how even like Facebook and Meta and these biohacking things, like there's always a crystal right there at the edge of their technology to interact with what they're trying to do or bring in or transform. Even tiny crystals, as you know. So time crystals, I don't have an ability to really like speak about it on a scientific level with, I've read about it and things, but I wouldn't have a lot of, I don't think I'd be a good contributor to like the scientific studies on time crystals, but I'll just say it in kind of like a more shamanic or healers type way of looking at it. You know, we're going towards the singularity. We're headed towards this time of oneness. We're about to start experiencing oneness where there is no space and no time. So in that process of moving towards that singularity, it's like we end up untrapping ourselves from time and untrapping certain things from time, because we have to kind of be like lifted out of the illusion of time as we're headed there. And if you look at crystals, like they are permanent, and that's why they always build the ancient sites out of crystals. Anytime they want to leave behind a record, they make it out of a stone. They don't make it out of a pine tree. I mean, anytime you want to tell a message to the future, you leave it in stone, because it's going to be there, because it's going to be there, because it's going to be there. Crystals and stones have this incredible relationship with permanence, and they have this incredible relationship with time, right? They stand the test of time. They keep living over these long, long cycles of time. So they can keep things trapped in time. And I think that we even talked about when we spoke before with some other students, we were talking about how some ancient sites, because of the energy that's already there, and because of the way that the stones can really hold that energy in time, store that information in time, that some ancient sites will be kind of corrupted with darker spells or bad intentions and painful things. And different civilizations or communities or people will come along and say, look at that ancient site. Let's put some bad energy into that, something that is oppressive, something that's separative, and put some spells on it. And then the crystals have that trapped in time. And I think that that's why some people go to ancient sites or places and they get a weird feeling. Stones have that ability to just store information forever. I've just been noticing that as I, you know, intend to move more towards this experience of oneness, that stones keep coming into my life to untrap me from moments of time. Think about releasing yourself from where you're trapped in time. And PTSD is like our common way to talk about this. Like if you go back to this room all of the time, and every time you go in that room, the site of your past trauma, you experience all those feelings again, like you get worked up again, your senses get heightened again, you're back in that trauma. All of these places that we leave ourselves, we want to untrap ourselves from time, right? And come back into the present. And that's what we often call soul retrieval. It's like untrapping ourselves from the past and the future and coming back into the present. And just to say it as simply as I possibly can, stones have an ability to store things and trap things in time. But guess what? They do the exact opposite too. They have the ability to untrap things from time, to bring us back to the present moment. It's like two sides of the same coin. So we can use stones to send messages to the future. We can use stones to go to points of place trauma and bring us back into the present. And that's via the relationship with time.
Amazing. I love how you're like, guess what? I love how you...
thanks for
you're a natural teacher, Sarah, and I know you've taught students for a long time in your courses. Could you just sort of run through what your teaching offerings are?
Yeah, so every fall I take people through a 9-week live online certification course where we spend a lot of time together. It's online, but I'm teaching live all the time. It's a tremendous journey through 9 weeks where we go through this ceremonial arc where you actually learn stone medicine by doing it on yourself. And you learn a lot of important mystical practices and stone medicine practices. And every week there's a practice that you do. So whether it's making a certain elixir or building a certain grid, you actually become a certified stone medicine practitioner by experiencing it. And that's called Enter the Cave. And so every fall we do that. You learn 27 stones according to ancient Taoist texts and beyond. So you have the full Materia Medica of 27 stones and their properties. Then in the spring, because, you know, 27 more stones wanted to come out, we have a course called Temple of Stone. And Temple of Stone is the mirror image to enter the cave. It's a different 9-week ceremonial arc, but I'm with you live online and I'm taking you through 27 different stones. So for example, in Temple of Stone, we learn calcite, we learn carnelian, we learn gold. In Enter the Cave, we learn kyanite, we learn morganite, we learn malachite, for example. So those are two times you can kind of study with me and get a lot of connection with me and asking questions and being present. But there are also, if you don't want to do a full certification course, we have 4 different courses that are, you know, take any time courses where you can dive in. One of them is the Cosmic Dragons course, where you learn how to do that transmutational work. Another one is called Stones for the 8 Extraordinary Meridians, where you learn to do a whole modality of soul healing through learning 8 different acupuncture points and what stones to put on them. And another one is how to make stone elixirs. So if you want to learn to make those safely and via different methods like flower essences or homeopathically or however you want to make it, or by ancient methods, that's another one. And the other one is the course that you and I have engaged in, which is the land healing and earth grid work course. So if you're a dragon person, a land healing person, you want to go out there and work with the earth, that's there too.
Wonderful. And then what's your own business daily structure? Like, what are you spending your time on sort of through the course of a week?
I've never been asked that before, Derek. That's amazing. I am spending time following my dogs around and following my cats around and cooking and being in the kitchen, you know, life. I do a lot of life in my home, like loving my animals and being, you know, cleaning the house. I love to clean. I love to cook. But business-wise, I am often, I'll do some podcasts here and there. I will do a lot of Q&As with students. I do a lot of writing and I do a lot of content creation. So I'll be creating something all the time, sitting down, creating whatever the course is going to be. And when I say writing, I mean, it's like I'm writing to people talking about what the courses are about and how, you know, how they can benefit from them. But that's my work life, I'd say.
And I'm kind of curious, like, how much, so you're teaching these courses, which are delivered online. I know you have a crystal shop. And you're, sounds like you're also seeing patients physically, like sort of how, what's the breakdown of these different aspects of your work?
Well, I go to the crystal shop about once a week and it's so awesome because I get dressed and go out and see my like family member crystal shop workers and be with all the stones. So I go there about once a week and the boss comes in and everyone's like, oh no, the boss is here. You know, it's quite the opposite. I'm like the goofball. But the other side of it is I'm just seeing friends and family as patients right now. I used to be just insane seeing patients. And because I'm just seeing friends and family, it's just like one treatment a week or so.
Cool. Yeah. So primarily like the online courses, and it's taking up a good chunk of your...
Yeah, I'm allowing myself to be a teacher because I, for some reason, I'm just so blessed. I learned so many things that I look around and I'm like, nobody knows this. Acupuncturists don't know this. Stone medicine people don't know this. I've just been so blessed what I've been taught. And I can't believe people don't learn it. I mean, people that are doctorates in acupuncture will be like, I've never heard of that incredible thing. And so I've allowed myself to be like, let me just, instead of doing the treatment on someone, let me teach 80 other people how to do it and they can do it on 8,000 people.
Yeah. There's just a couple more things that I wanted to ask you about. You've talked before about monatomic elements. Again, probably the only person I've heard talk about these things. But there, I noticed they're starting to get more popular, these elixirs where people make something called Ormus, orbitally rearranged monatomic something or other. So they're starting, I think, to get more popular. But what's the power of monatomic elements?
It is such a fucking, oops, I said F word. It's such a cool, fantastic field of study. Oh gosh. I mean, so there are certain elements that when they exist as one atom, they take on these incredible, magical, mystical, trans-dimensional properties. Usually atoms are all combined. And there's this amazing thing where elements like gold, platinum, mercury, copper, there's a few elements that can actually exist as one atom. And if you get this one atom, it actually can move in and out of this dimension. People heat them up and they'll see them start to levitate and then disappear. There's this beautiful story of this farmer who came upon this by accident, just this regular guy who was a farmer. And he started watching, he actually went and got these minerals from another place. I think it was like an Ohio or something. He brought them back to his place, which was like, I think Nevada. And he was like just experimenting with soils, and he created this combination, and this thing that he created burst into a flash of light and disappeared. And it essentially imploded into the singularity because they were monatomic elements. Nonetheless, when you ingest monatomic elements, you get this superconductive capacity in your own body, which is the ability to channel, I'm just going to call it the fifth dimension, the ability to channel that oneness, that unified field with no resistance whatsoever. So that superconductivity, there's no resistance. And over time, as you slowly kind of like build up your relationship with them, because it's very much alive. I mean, this is an alchemist procedure. And alchemist means that you have to be in some kind of tune with it. Like, you're an important part of the equation. But when people have these in their body, they have these mystical experiences. I just gave someone some monatomic gold. I was sitting in a small ceremony at my house. We had about 12 women over. We were doing meditation. We did some breath work, and I passed around some monatomic gold before it. And one woman came up to me afterwards. She's like, oh my God, what was that? As soon as I put that on my tongue, I went into another dimension. And she had a full on ceremony, all this information coming in, all of this frequency being cleared. Like, she, just like the monatomic elements themselves, she went to another dimension and had, you know, what you would think would be like a psychedelic ceremony in an afternoon. Amazing.
Sorry, I just realized my computer is unplugged and about to die there.
Okay.
Monatomics, yeah. I heard they're also in chocolate. Is that that there are certain foods and compounds that these monatomics are naturally found?
Yeah, monatomic gold is found in cacao. There's some monatomic gold, I think, found in grapes. But yeah, you can look up. They're everywhere, honestly, Derek. Like, there's some monatomics in everything. The crystals are full of monatomic elements, especially crystals that you would get by any kind of volcano. But crystals in general are full. And that's so much the reason why they're giving us these kind of multidimensional mysterious effects. But yes, you can look up, like, what are all the common foods that have high concentrations of monatomics?
And where did you get yours that you gave this woman? Is it like a powder that you have or something?
Yeah, I should I say the name of a company?
You may, sure.
Okay, good. I don't want to, you know, exclude any companies or whatever, but one of the companies that I think is like just pretty sound to work with is called ZP Tech.
Okay.
And they'll send you these tiny little bottles of the powders. And they're a pretty solid company. They're just pretty sound. But there are other companies that are really amazing too. There's some Shilajit companies. Shilajit is full of monatomic elements. It's basically what is compounded so deep under mountains. It's kind of like the semen of a mountain. It's the rich life energy force inside a mountain. So it's incredible, full of monatomics. And there's some companies that have really kind of transformed how you would take Shilajit and have it in the most pure compounds too. I would look that up too.
Cool.
Yeah.
And then, okay, so I've still got a couple more non sort of sequiturs. I know we're jumping around here, but one common thing that a lot of people have in their homes now is granite countertops, these sort of large scale granite. Like, is there anything that can be done with the granite slabs that everybody has?
That is such a weird question, too. It's so cool. I commend you for asking me questions that nobody's ever asked me. granite is mica, quartz, and feldspar. It definitely has important properties. Granite was hauled places all the time to create and construct ancient sites because of the piezoelectric nature of the quartz. But mica has its own really special properties, and so does feldspar. And anytime you have a combination like that, it's going to be the alchemy of the combined minerals, not like separated properties of each mineral. So granite has its own, you know, frequency. I'm not sure. I'm thinking about what someone could do with a granite countertop. I mean, it's what granite would be done with in the past is to use the piezoelectrical effect to make the mechanical pressure turn into electrical pressure. And then they would induce these electromagnetic fields around those sites. And there's more to it, but gosh, I mean, perhaps somebody could say, I'm looking at my granite countertop and this part's really cool. I see like a big wide section of quartz right here, or just like this beautiful moment. Perhaps they could make their elixirs there, you know, have their own little power spot in their countertop.
Okay.
I'll keep thinking about that.
All right. Fair enough. Yeah. And then I wanted to ask about gemstones, like faceted gems. I heard Sadhguru talking about this, like you have to have a gemstone over 2 carats and you wear it and it's like major healing. You know, he calls it like an astrological gemstone or something like that. What's the benefit of faceting a gemstone?
The common benefit of it is that you really, really get to see the beauty of the crystal, and they will cut it in such a way that kind of like the refractive index of the crystal, which is how that crystal interacts with light, what it does when light hits it. Crystals all have a different relationship with light, the way they bounce light around inside of it and then project it back out. Like, so diamond has a very, very high rate of dispersion. It's not the highest, but rate of dispersion, I mean, it's going to be really sparkly. Like light is going to come in and get jostled all around in so many ways and come out in rainbows and sparkles. And the way that you cut it can definitely enhance that. It can just make you really be able to see that color and that light play so much more. So basically in the world of gems, that's just what they're thinking about. Like they're just thinking about how do we make this gorgeous and beautiful. When you get into like Vedic gemology, and how that cut crystal might interact with the influences of planets upon you and favorable planets. I am not sure exactly if there are, you know, certain kind of cuts that have certain relationships with planets. I've never heard that, or certain kind of, I know certain gemstones have certain relationships with planets, but I'm not sure if there's a certain kind of cut or why you would cut it in a certain way to relate to different planets. I could think of, it probably makes sense just to go general resonance that if you cut the stone in a circle, or if you cut the stone in an oval, or if you cut the stone in, you know, like a soft square, or you cut the stone in a square, you cut the stone in the diamond, I think you could pull out some resonance factors with planets through that. I don't know much about like the different cut patterns. Like there's all these different ways they facet and cut stones that are like really particular. I don't know much about that.
And royalty have put gemstones on their, you know, jewelry for a long time. I know partly because of their rarity, but also my thinking is like bestows special, you know, abilities on them. Any thoughts about that?
I was just reading recently about how the Mayans, the ancient Mayans, would actually get gemstones drilled into their teeth. Have you seen that? So that their teeth, there would just be like an emerald in the middle of their teeth. Yeah. Or like a blue aquamarine right in the middle of their teeth. And I've been thinking a lot about why they did that. But yeah, I think that people knew that stones absorb, store, and transmit energy. And in that, you know, people in high courts, like emperors, kings, all this, they were so obsessed with what we might call like superstition these days, but they were so obsessed with like someone setting a bad spell and knocking them off the throne, or someone setting a bad spell to like kill their whole army, or someone, you know, doing something to get them from that position to take their land. And so they always had magicians around them. You know, they always had sorcerers around them. They had alchemists around them. There was always like warding off all of this and keeping them on the throne. So they knew a lot about, you know, the wars between light and dark. And they were always talking about, you know, this gemstone, if it changes color, you know, someone's attacking you. Like if it subtly changes color, or this gemstone is something that, you know, will warn you of like someone, betraying you, or this gemstone, you know, if you want to go out in public and people not recognize you, so you can just like walk around among the people and not be seen in the marketplace and kind of like check out what's going on, this gemstone will actually like cloak you. So there's a lot of like magical arts going on around that.
Cool.
Yeah.
Is there anything I haven't asked you about yet that you want to share that's important for you to share?
Well, I think what comes to mind when you ask that, thank you for the space to ask that question. I think what comes to mind is just, you know, I want people to hear this and be like, you know what, I'm going to let my inner woo, like just let them have a little bit more of a seat at the table. And when I have a deep intuition or I'm just drawn to something or those little moments of magic in my life, like the moments where I just know, like there's just these moments where we just know, or this moment where your beard might like do a little tingle, you know, it has to go a certain way. I really, you know, stand up for that part of myself and let that part out and let those moments like not only live and be expressed and like, hey, I feel like going to the crystal store, like go to the crystal store and have fun with that. You know, like let that not only live and express, but let it be a point of joy in your life. And that's something that I've been, you know, feel like nurturing in my life and in my student community. And it'd be nice for other people to hear that right now too, I think.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. And where do you want to direct people to find you?
They can go to upperclarity.com.
Perfect.
Yeah. And we had a 56 episode podcast at one point that we took a couple year break, and I'm going to start talking and sharing again. So anybody can tune in for free for little snippets and things coming up soon. It's called the Crystal Clarity Podcast.
Exciting.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, Sarah, thanks for spending time with me today.
Yeah. I love the crop circle behind you.
Oh yes. That's my, I had something like, I don't know, 1,000 crop circles that I sorted through to pick the one that I would print off and put on my wall. I dreamed of crop circles every night for months, and I started doing crop circle research. Like what is going on with these crop circles? It's really fascinating, and they're so beautiful. This is the only one that I've ever seen that's projected three-dimensionally. So for people listening, it's sort of a outward, it comes off of the page, off of the land, 12, they're almost like 12 crystals coming off of this central star, which is a pretty, pretty unique one.
It does. It looks 3D.
But I know that all crop circles are over giant quartz deposits. And if you look at like a map of where they're found, there's these very clear delineations of where crop circles stop when the geology, underlying geology changes. So there's like the crop circle part of, you know, the UK, and then there's the not crop circle part where you just don't find them.
Beautiful. And there's also that, the aquifer piece, that when there's water and crystals, it's like a really good spot. Underground water.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was a good marriage.
Cool.
Well, Derek, you're really good at this. You are really good at this.
I'm so
glad you're podcasting and interviewing people, because there's so many dimensions to doing that well, and you're really good at it. So thanks for sharing that with the world.
Appreciate you saying that.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll wrap there, and thanks again, and we'll talk again soon.
Okay. Bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye.